Chapter 6, Sherry and Greg's Story. The original Night Stalker attacked and murdered his fifth and sixth victims, Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez, in the quiet town of Santa Barbara, California, on July 27, 1981. Debbie was 15 years old at the time.
My name is Debbie Domingo McMullen. And when I was a teenager, my mom and her boyfriend were murdered by the Golden State Killer. When I was about 10 or so, we moved to the Santa Barbara area. And not very long after that, my dad and mom separated. Dad was settled in San Diego with my stepmom and her sons. And then my brother chose to live with my dad and stepmom as well. Within the first year or two after the divorce, life, for the most part, was just me and mom. Santa Barbara is about midway through the state, right on the coast, and it's nestled kind of in between the shoreline and the foothills of a little mountain range. There's a bit of a Spanish influence, so you'll see a lot of kind of stucco-type homes and a lot of greenery, a lot of oak trees and palm trees and everything you can imagine in between. The ocean is just gorgeous. You can walk into different restaurants and shops, kind of the old historic parts of town. The soundtrack of my life includes music from the Eagles and Jim Croce and Firefall and, you know, this kind of easy listening 1970s kind of an atmosphere. We spent a lot of time together, just her and I. We liked to shop and we liked to go to the beach and we liked museums and the Mission. It was just kind of like gal pals. She was very young and very pretty, very vibrant, very attractive. And we would be out somewhere and I'd yell out, "Hey, Mom!" And heads would turn because they'd look at her and go, "Whoa, she's your mom?" Because she just had that kind of young air about her. When I was little, my mom was the ultimate homemaker. She made sure that our house was always clean and comfortable. She made clothes for us and Halloween costumes. And she cooked nearly everything from scratch. She baked beautifully. She was always either humming or singing something. I look back on it now and I think she did well. She did really well. I think she felt alone, but she made the best of it. She was an optimist. She dated a few guys the first year or two. There was nothing very remarkable about them. But within the first year or so, she met Greg Sanchez. And Greg was just too cool. He was wonderful. My mom and Greg would date exclusively for long periods of time. And then for some reason or another, they would split up. Greg was significantly younger than she was. She was 35 and he was 27. And Greg was, he was real. And I don't know how else to put that. There were a few of the guys that she dated that they always seemed like they were trying to show off. Oh, I've got this hot car, or oh, I've got this good job, or oh, I'm so good looking. And, or oh, if this gets serious, I might be your new stepdad. But Greg never did any of that. I remember whenever Greg was around, Mom seemed happy. Greg and I had this funny kind of joking relationship. He called me Deborah D. And, you know, he'd just be like, "Hey, Deborah D, are you ready for dinner?" And I'd say, "Greg, my name's not Deborah, it's Debbie." And he'd say, "No, it's all right, I can call you Deborah." He was the only one who ever got away with that. Physically, when you would look at my mom and Greg together, it was kind of like night and day, because she was 5'4" and very, very petite. And Greg was at least 6 foot tall. Some said he was 6'4". He was very muscular. He was the epitome of tall, dark, and handsome. Dark brown hair, nice full mustache. His eyes sparkled. He was just handsome. His legs were like tree trunks. He played softball on a team with his brothers. And at some point, I remember seeing him, and he had the baseball pants on, but he didn't yet have the socks and the shoes on. And I remember looking and going, "What are you wearing capris for?" And he just laughed and he says, "Deborah, these are my baseball pants." And I said, "What are you talking about?" I don't remember ever hearing the two of them talk about marriage, but there were hints along the way. And I think Greg wanted to be married. And my mom, she never really talked about it much, but looking back now, I think she was gun shy. I think the divorce was very, very painful for her. And I think that she loved Greg, and I think she was scared. As I got older, I started to get more and more kind of selfish and wrapped up into what I want. And there would be times that Mom and I would have arguments, and I would threaten, no, I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to go live with Dad. I got to where I was pushing limits. I was breaking curfews. I don't even like to admit this in public, but I was sexually active way too early. And I think my parents had reason to be concerned about my behavior. And anytime that I was confronted or they tried to put limits on me, I would just rebel against that and say, you know what, I'm making my own decisions. It's not your life, it's my life. By the time I was finishing up 10th grade, I was just about to turn 16, I started to get just this huge selfishness going on. And I don't know where that came from, but I'm sorry. Wow. I don't know where this wave of emotion just came from. My mom, she and I had just fought and fought and fought. And I don't even remember the specifics of the arguments, but I packed up a bunch of clothes into a backpack and I took off on my bike. And I thought, you know what? I don't have to live with your rules. I'll just go live somewhere with my friends. So I showed up at the doorstep of a girlfriend, and her parents would let me stay there for 3 or 4 days. And then I would leave there and go find another girlfriend to stay with. And so by the time it was summer after my 10th grade year, I was pretty much a runaway. Mom and I hadn't seen each other, well, probably about 3 or 4 weeks. I had this little part-time job at a movie theater. It's a beautiful, beautiful theater in downtown Santa Barbara called the Granada Theater. Greg had gotten a hold of me at the theater and invited me out to lunch. And that was a first for us. Greg and I had never gone anywhere, just the two of us, before. And he and Mom weren't together at the time. They had broken up. So I rode my bike and I got to this hamburger place and we sat down and he bought me a hamburger. He said that he wanted to let me know that he was getting ready to move out of state and he wanted to say goodbye. And I was absolutely blown away. And I said, what do you mean? You can't, where could you possibly go? You know, what about my mom? What about me? What, you can't leave us. He said, I've asked your mom to marry me so many times and she just won't. I can't keep waiting and hoping for her to marry me. The reality is that at some point he came to my mom's house the evening of July 26, 1981, and he ended up staying the night. And during that night is when the killer broke into our house and killed my mom and Greg.
Debbie describes a typical post-divorce American family, a low-risk family that would ordinarily have nothing to worry about in the safety of their own home. The fact that Greg, a strapping 6'4" man, is in the home that night would typically mean the home is that much safer from outside harm. But the original Night Stalker has something to prove. He actually targets homes with male and female couples, so he can control and dominate the male, effectively emasculating him, before raping the woman and killing them both.
Everybody always says, if I had known that was going to be the last time I saw you or the last time I talked to you, I would have done things different or I would have said something different. My last conversation with my mom is something that has hung with me for all of my life. And I had left home in the early part of July, and I had been staying with girlfriends, staying on people's couches. And at one point, I remember being downtown Santa Barbara. I was on my bicycle. This just sounds so dumb. I remember I had left my favorite bathing suit at home when I stormed out. So I stopped at a payphone, and yes, these were real things. I dug some change out of my pocket, and I called my mom, and she answered the phone. And I said, I left my bathing suit there. I need to come get it. And she said, no. And I remember thinking, what do you mean, no? It's my bathing suit. And she came back with something like, well, it's my house. And when I left, I made the choice to not live there anymore. And anything that I left behind, I had forfeited. And I'm screaming at her, why won't you let me? No, you can't have it. You can't come over. You're not coming in this house. And I'm standing on this street corner, and I'm at this payphone, and I'm so selfish, such a selfish little monster I was. And I screamed at her, why don't you just stay out of my life? And I hung up the phone. I slammed that receiver down. And I rode away on my bicycle, and I went and met my friends, and everything was fine. And, you know, I'm sure I told all these horrible stories about, oh, yeah, my mean mom won't let me do this, won't let me do that, won't let me have my stuff. And it was all about me. And I can't even imagine what her part of that conversation was. She had to have been alone in that home and worried about her 15-year-old daughter who was on the street. She didn't know where I was staying. She didn't know who I was with. She didn't know if I was eating. She didn't know if I had a safe place to sleep. All she knew was that her bratty daughter did not want to surrender any kind of power or pride. Her heart had to have been breaking, but she summoned up the strength to stand her ground and to let me know that I couldn't just do whatever I wanted to do. I don't know how the rest of that day went for her, but I do know that the next day I was at a girlfriend's house and somebody called the Granada Theater where I worked looking for me. I got a phone call that said, you need to come home. I was still mad from the day before, with all of my pride and all of my indignation, and no, I don't have to do what she says. And my mom's friend on the other end of that phone says, no, Debbie, you have to come home. And I'm thinking, no, you're just going to try and make peace. You're just going to try and get me to agree to do what she says. And I don't have to. And she said, no, Debbie, you don't understand. It's important. You have to come home. And I remember sighing and thinking, okay, fine. If it's that important, fine. So I got a friend to drive me home. And as we got close to the house, we got close to the cul-de-sac, the first thing I remember seeing was yellow tape. And I really was speechless. I remember looking at that yellow tape and going, oh, man. She said it was important, but what the heck? Because everybody knows what yellow tape means. Yellow tape means somebody's dead. And I couldn't even fathom. I mean, honestly, my mind was just racing like it is right now. Just racing, going, man, what in the world could have happened for all these police and all of these news cameras and all of this yellow tape? What in the world is going on? But the car stopped, and I got out, and I walked towards the house, and I'm looking at the tape. The yellow tape went across the end of the cul-de-sac, all the way around our house, all the way around the front yard. My mom's car was in the driveway. She drove a 1979 Datsun 280Z, very sporty, chocolate brown with that little metallic flake in the paint. And I'm looking at this house, and there's yellow tape everywhere, and there's people everywhere. And there's cops walking in and out of the front door, back and forth to the vehicles that were parked in the street. And I looked around the cul-de-sac, and there were reporters and news cameras, and there were neighbors everywhere, little groups of neighbors, two or three over here, and four or five over here, and everybody's talking and looking over towards our house, and pointing and making gestures, and it was obvious that nobody really understood what was going on. They were all just looking at that yellow tape too. And as I stepped toward the house, I remember my mom's friend was the first one to find me, and she was saying, yes, this is Sherry's daughter, this is Debbie. And almost immediately, my eyes strayed over to the right a little bit, and I spotted Greg's car. Greg drove this fantastic little Camaro, white Camaro with the big fat racing stripe kind of thing painted on the hood. I saw Greg's car, and for just a minute, my heart leapt. I thought, oh, good, Greg's here. If Greg's here, everything's going to be all right. I spouted out, where's Greg? I want to see Greg. And somebody said, Greg who? What are you talking about? Who's Greg? And I said, Greg Sanchez. That's his car right there. Where is he? I want to see Greg. I very quickly got escorted across the street and around the corner to my mom's friend's house. I remember sitting down, and my mom's friend was sitting next to me. And the police were all around me. And I don't know if it was one or two officers, but I remember somebody just looking me in the eye and saying, we don't have all the details, but there are two bodies in your house, and we believe that one of them is your mother. And I thought, two bodies? Wait a minute, how is that possible? How is that even possible? And I thought, well, wait a minute. If there are two bodies in the house, what, did they have an argument? And Greg killed her and then killed himself. What in the world is going on? I just remember thinking, man, this cannot be happening. And then the smart aleck teenager in me, kind of, the little voice kicked in from the side and said, two bodies and they think one of them is my mother. Duh. Of course there's one of them is my mother. What? Who else could it be? And then I went back to, oh my gosh, is my mom really dead? And in all of this, I mean, as I'm sitting here thinking about it and talking about it now, I'm just blubbering. There are tears pouring. But in all of that, I don't think I blinked, and I don't think I cried. I think I was just stunned. I don't know. In my mind, there's just all of these images that just race through of my mother nurturing me and taking care of me and reading to me and singing to me. And shopping with me and yelling at me and me yelling back. I'm thinking, why don't you just stay out of my life? And that's not what I meant. That was not what I meant. My knowledge of the murders has come in stages. I was never allowed to go back into the house itself. The police sat me down that very, you know, within the first few minutes that I arrived at the scene. I was in my mom's friend, her name is Marna. I was in Marna's house in her living room, and I think she was seated on that couch next to me, and police maybe pulled up a chair close in front of me to talk to me. And they asked so many questions, and really it was apparent to me that they were just grasping at straws. They asked outlandish things like, did your mom do drugs? Could somebody have broken into the house to steal drugs and killed your mom and Greg in the process? They asked me about other boyfriends, if there were, you know, other men that she had dated besides Greg that might have gotten jealous. I don't think the word rape ever came into the equation. And in later years, you know, I started to gather more information and piece together what had actually happened. But that was way, 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 way later, like 20 years later, that they had both been bludgeoned to death and that there was a gun used. Greg was shot one time. And the way I understand it, that bullet went through the cheek and back out again. So that shot incapacitated him for some time, but did not kill him. And that my mom and Greg were both beaten with some sort of heavy object. Didn't know for a very long time what kind of an object, if it was a vase or a lamp. I think it's been determined that the bludgeon had to have been some kind of a tool that came from the outside of the house. From the time that I found out that Mom and Greg had been killed, almost immediately, Marna said to me, you need to call your dad. And so I called my dad in San Diego, and he immediately drove up to be at my side and to kind of walk me through the logistics. So my dad came to town. The police had questioned him just relentlessly. And I didn't realize it until years later. They actually took my dad into the house and into the master bedroom with all of the blood spatter, and they interrogated him for hours and hours and hours. And of course, that's, I mean, you look at police work, that's what you do. Somebody dies, you look at the ex. After the murders, I stayed at Marna's house. My dad stayed there as well. I have been fortunate enough over the years to reconnect with Marna. She has told me that she was really uncomfortable because the police had been questioning my dad as far as his involvement in possibly the murders. And she was like, okay, the man can't afford a hotel and he's here from out of town and this is turbulent and we need to be, you know, do the Christian neighborly thing and put him up. But what if he's the killer?
Murders are more seriously and intensely investigated by law enforcement than any other type of crime. Those investigations can be distasteful and painful for family members. They are often the first people that have to be ruled out as suspects. To accelerate this process, they're offered a polygraph.
At the sheriff's office, I remember taking a lie detector test, and they asked me specifically, "Do you know who killed your mother?" And they said, "Did you have something to do with your mother's death?" I mean, it was just, it was the kind of thing that just had me shaking my head going, whoa. I mean, I remember just thinking, man, how desperate are they for answers that they're looking at me? I mean, I was just blown away. And I know they were doing a good job. I do not mean to imply that the police were inept in any way. I think they worked that crime scene. I think they worked every single lead they could possibly work. I think they turned over every stone they could find. And there was nothing to go on. Once they finished processing the crime scene, they said, okay, now you can get your things out of the home.
There are at least two reasons why law enforcement would exclude a family member from the scene of a homicide. The first is to protect the crime scene from contamination by the family member. The second is to protect the family members from the horrors that were visited upon the victims at the scene.
Finally, at some point, somebody said to me, and I'm sure it was somebody from the sheriff's office, said, "No, you don't understand, young lady. You can't go back in there. It's too messy." And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I was allowed to go in as far as the garage. Police would bring a piece of furniture or a vase or something. Man, Dad must have rented a U-Haul, and we were loading our belongings into this truck. I remember just being so frustrated that I wasn't allowed to go back inside. Over the years, I've never known what happened to Mom's purse or her wallet or her driver's license or her address book. I mean, just basic kinds of stuff. Later on in my life, I had turbulent years where I moved around a lot. I was homeless for a time period. I had a storage garage that I couldn't pay for, and so stuff got confiscated and auctioned off. So over the years, I've lost track of a lot of things that were my mom's, her pieces of her clothing and her jewelry. It has always lingered with me as an unknown chapter. I came away from Santa Barbara with this kind of unfinished aspect where I said goodbye to people. I'd be like, okay, I'm going back to Dad's house. And a lot of those connections there were severed for a very, very, very long time. People would say, you know, "Debbie, we heard about what happened. How are you doing?" And I would just say, "I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm getting through this. I'm okay."
People process trauma differently. Some live life in a perpetual fog afterwards. Others report a complete emotional shutdown. There's no question that trauma can have profound and long-lasting effects on those who suffer through it. Debbie describes her reaction this way.
My mom and Greg's deaths were my first experiences with death. I had never lost a person. I'd never been to a funeral before. And to compound that with not just death, but violent, horrific, brutal death, I just had no clue how to handle any of that. So I just chose not to. We tried one counseling session, I think, my brother and I together, and I don't remember anything about it other than that was the one and only session we ever did. So apparently it didn't didn't go real well. And I ended up just really internalizing a lot of the trauma and the loss and the grief and moving forward with a life that did make sense. I had school and theater and church and just kind of moving forward with day-to-day life. And investigation-wise, if there was news from the sheriff's department about the crime, things that they were learning, if they had any suspects, if they had any leads, that was never communicated to me. By the end of the first year, and certainly by the time I finished high school, it was just obvious to me that the case was cold. It was never going to be solved. They were never going to figure it out. And whatever they did have was sitting in a file box on a shelf, gathering dust, and it was never, ever going to be solved. And for all of that to be packaged up into a box full of file folders and forgotten about was just so troubling. And so it just made me so sad. I started to get depression kinds of issues. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I started experimenting with drugs, and I ended up getting hooked on methamphetamine, and I lost probably close to 10 years living on welfare. I just had some really, really ugly, ugly chapters of my life. My natural optimism just kind of went by the wayside, and I kept thinking, you know what? This is life. There had been a few times in this 20-year period that I had dared to pick up a phone and call Santa Barbara Sheriff's Office and say, hey, my name's Debbie Domingo. You've probably never heard of me or my mom, but there's this unsolved murder from 1981. Is there anybody there who can update me on the case? And always with the answer of, well, yes, the case is never officially closed, but we don't have anything new. And, you know, you can only make that phone call so many times before you just think, I ain't calling anymore. I don't want to hear no news anymore. My mom. When you lose somebody, there's always the tendency to remember the good things, remember the smile and the generosity and the music and the laugh. There are so many songs that I relate to her and to Greg. I remember being with Greg at one point and hearing Baby Come Back on the radio. Baby Come Back. He said, that's my song for your mom. And I was like, okay, Greg, whatever. But during that time, they were together. So I just kind of chuckled at that. She, the Pina Colada song, where he's reading the classifieds and he's with his girlfriend, but he's reading the classifieds and thinking there may be other fish in the sea. And so he writes to this one and he's going to meet her. And it turns out to be his girlfriend. And it's like, that was pretty typical of mom and Greg. They were together. They'd break up. So the Pina Colada song is one that every time I hear it, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, Mom and Greg, they break up, but they're always going to end up back together eventually. And in some strange, ironic way, you know, they were broken up when they died, but they were killed together. So in my heart and soul, I'm like, okay, yeah, ultimately, they're together. They just are.